The Saffron Robe by Tuesday Love Sang Rampa, read to you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC, December 2016. Chapter 3. I thought of my guide, the Lama Mingyar Dondup, who had had to go to distant Paris very suddenly. I thought of all the questions which were welling up in me and which only he could answer. Never mind, tomorrow he would return, and then I should be glad to get back to Shakpori. Here at the Patala there was too much ceremony, too much red tape. Yes, I had a lot of questions which were bothering me, and I could hardly wait for an answer. A swelling noise had been for some moments obtruding on my consciousness. Now the volume of sound reminded me of a herd of yaks in full charge. Into the classroom erupted all the boys. Yes, they were playing at being a herd of yaks. I sidled carefully to the back of the room and sat down close to the wall, out of the way of those who raced around. Round and round they went, leapfrogging one after the other, robes flying, voices raised in shrieks of joy. Suddenly there was a loud whoomph, and a gasp of violently expelled air. Dead silence fell upon the room, with boys frozen into position like carved figures in the temple. My horrified gaze saw the Indian teacher sitting on the floor, his eyes crossed and unfocused with the shock. Now his bowl and barley had been spilled from his robe, I thought with some glee. Slowly he stirred and climbed shakily to his feet, clutching the wall and looking about him. I was the only one sitting. I obviously had had no part in it. Oh, the wonderful, strange feeling to have a perfectly clear conscience. I swelled with virtue as I sat there. On the ground, half stunned or petrified with fright, lay the boy who had dived straight at the spare midriff of the Indian teacher. The boy's nose was bleeding, but the Indian touched him with an ungentle foot and bellowed, "Get up!" Bending, he grabbed the boy by the ears and pulled him up. "Disgraceful, horrid little Tibetan scum!" he bawled, slapping the boy's ears in time to his words. "I will teach you how to behave to an Indian gentleman. I will teach you yoga that will mortify the flesh so that the spirit may be freed." I must ask my guide, I thought, to tell me why some of these great teachers from other lands are so savage. The scowling teacher stopped knocking the boy about and said, "We will have an extended lesson period to teach you that you should be learning instead of being ill-mannered. Now we will start." I called out, "Oh, but honorable master, I was doing nothing at all. It is not fair that I should have to stay." The Indian turned a ferocious face in my direction and said, You would be the worst of the lot. Just because you are crippled and useless, it doesn't mean that you should escape the retribution of your thoughts. You will stay, as will the others." He picked up his scattered papers, and I was sorry to see that the beautiful leather bag with the handle across the top and the shiny button which opened it had been scuffed by contact with our rough stone floor. The Indian noticed it and growled, Someone will pay very dearly for this. I shall claim another from the Futala. He opened his case and rifled through his papers, sorting them out. At last, satisfied, he said, "We ended this morning with Gautama stating that he renounced his life at the palace, stating that he would continue his life searching for truth. And now, let us continue." When Gautama had left the palace of his father, the king, his mind was in turmoil. He had undergone a most shattering sudden experience of seeing illness when he had not known of illness, of seeing death when he had not known of death, and of seeing peace profound, utter tranquility and contentment. His thoughts were that as the wearer of the contented look was also wearing a monk's robe, then contentment and inner peace would be found in the garb of a monk, and thus it was that he set forth on his search for inner tranquility in his search for the meaning of life. He wandered on and on into the realms beyond those over which his father ruled, on and on, following rumors of learned monks and erudite hermits. He studied with the best teachers that he could find, studying whenever there was anything to be learned. As he learned from one teacher all that the teacher could teach him, he moved on, ever in search of knowledge, ever in search of the most elusive thing on earth, peace of mind, tranquility. Gautama was a very apt pupil. He had been favored of life. He had been given an alert brain and a bright awareness. He was able to pick up information and sort it in his mind, rejecting that which was useless to him, and retaining only matter which was of benefit and worth. One of the great teachers, impressed by Gautama's readiness and acute intelligence, asked him that he should stay and teach, asked him to become a full partner in imparting knowledge to other students. But this was quite alien to Gautama's belief, for he reasoned, how could he teach that which he did not fully understand? How could he teach others when he was still searching for truth himself? He knew the scriptures and the commentaries of the scriptures, but while the scriptures gave a certain degree of peace, yet there was always questions and problems which broke the tranquility which he was trying to gain, and thus Gautama wandered on. He was as a man obsessed, a man with a burning drive which permitted him no rest, spurring him on and on in search of knowledge, in search of truth. One hermit led him to believe that only the ascetic life could lead him to tranquility, so a rather impetuous Gautama tried the life of the ascetic. Long ago he had shed all material things. He had no material pleasures. He lived only to search for the meaning behind life. But now he forced himself to eat less and less, and as the old stories say, at last he managed to live on one grain of rice a day. He spent the whole of his time in the deepest of meditation, remaining immobile beneath the shade of a banyan tree. But at last, his sparse diet betrayed him. He collapsed through hunger, malnutrition, and a lack of elementary care. For long he lingered at the point of death, but no enlightenment reached him. He still had not found the secret of tranquility. he still had not found the meaning behind the most elusive thing on earth, peace of mind, tranquility. Certain friends had gathered about him during the days of his starvation, thinking that here was a sensation, a monk who could live on one grain of rice a day, thinking that they would gain great advantages by being associated with such a sensational man. But, like friends the world over, these deserted him in the hour of his need. As Gotama lay near the point of death through starvation, his friends, one by one, left him, wandered off in search of sensation elsewhere. Gotama was now alone again, free from the distraction of friends, free from followers, free to start pondering all over again on the meaning behind life. This episode was the turning point in the career of Gotama. For years he'd been practicing yoga that he might, by mortifying the flesh, free the spirit from the bonds of the body. But now he found yoga useless to him. Yoga was merely a means of gaining a little discipline over a recalcitrant body, and had no great merit in assisting one to spirituality. He also found that it was useless to lead such an austere life, because continued austerity would merely result in his death, with his questions unanswered and his quest unended. He pondered upon that problem too, and decided that what he had been doing was like trying to bail out the river Ganges with a sieve, or trying to tie knots in the air. Once again, Gotama pondered as he sat down beneath a tree, weak and trembling, with the weakness which comes upon those who have starved too long, but barely escaped death. He sat beneath the trees and meditated deeply upon the problem of unhappiness and suffering. He made a solemn resolve that, as he had already spent more than 6 years in the search for knowledge without gaining the answer, he would sit in meditation and he would not rise up again until he had found the answer to his problem. Gotama sat, and the sun went down, and darkness fell upon the land, and the night birds began their calling, and the animals began their prowling. Gotama sat. The long hours of the night dragged on, and soon the first faint streaks of light appeared in the sky. The dawn was approaching. Gotama sat and meditated. All the creatures of nature had witnessed the sufferings of the weary Gotama the day before, as he sat alone beneath the great tree. He had their sympathy, their understanding, and all the creatures of nature considered in their minds how they could help mankind struggle out of the difficult ways into which he had fallen. The tigers ceased to roar that their song and their callings should not disturb the meditating Gotama. The monkeys ceased to chatter, ceased to swing from branch to branch. Instead, they sat silent, hoping, hoping. The birds ceased their song, ceased their trilling, and sat instead, fluttering their wings, in the hopes of being able to help Gotama by sending to him waves of love and waves of cooling air. The dogs, normally barking and chasing around, ceased their noise and went away and hid beneath the bushes, hid where the rays of the sun should not fall upon them. The king of the snails, looking about him, saw the dogs disappearing in the shade, and the king of snails thought how he and his people could help mankind through Gautama. Calling his people together, the king of snails slowly led the way up Gautama's back, up his neck, and they clustered upon his sun-reddened head, that head so deep in meditation, that head so scorched by the burning rays of the sun. The snails clustered, and with their cool bodies protected Gautama from the heat of the noonday sun. And who knows, those snails, by keeping Gautama's head cool, may have helped him in his final quest. The people of nature at one time were the friends of man. They had no fear of man, and until man behaved treacherously towards them, the people of nature came forward to help man. The day dragged on and on, dragged on with Gautama sitting motionless as a carved statue. Once again the night came, the darkness. Once again with the approaching dawn, there came faint streaks in the light, and then the sun brushed upon the horizon. But this time, the sun brought Buddha enlightenment. As if struck by lightning, a thought occurred to Gautama. He had an answer, or a partial answer, to the problems with which he had been beset. He had become enlightened with a new knowledge. He had become the awakened one, which in Indian is the Buddha. His spirit had been illumined by that which had occurred during his meditation on the astral plane. He had gained insight, and he had remembered the things which he had seen in the astral plane. Now, as he knew, he would be free from the unhappiness of life on earth, free of returning to earth in the endless cycle of birth, death, and rebirth. He had gained knowledge of why man should suffer. What caused it? What was its nature? How could it be ended? Gautama, from that moment, became Gautama the Awakened, or to use the Indian phraseology, Gautama the Buddha. Now, he pondered again as what his course of action should be. He had suffered and studied, and so, should he just teach others, or should he let them find out by means of which he himself had found out? He worried, would anyone else believe the experiences he had undergone? But he decided that the only way to gain an answer to this was to talk with others, to tell them the good news of the enlightenment which had come to him. Rising to his feet and taking a little food and water, he set out on the journey to Benares, where he had hoped he would find five of those former associates who had left him when he was in dire need of assistance, who had left him when he decided again to take food. After a journey which lasted quite a time, for Gautama the Buddha was still weak from his privation, he arrived at Benares, and then he met the five associates whom he had been seeking. He talked with them and gave them that which had come down through history as the sermon on the turning of the wheel of the law. He told his audience of the cause of suffering, of the nature of suffering. He told them how to overcome suffering. He told them of a new religion which is known to us as Buddhism. Buddhism means a religion of those seeking to be reawakened. So Gautama knew hunger, I thought. I knew hunger too. I wish that this teacher would have more understanding, for we boys, we never had too much to eat. We never had too much time to ourselves. And with his voice droning on, long beyond the allotted time, we were hungry, tired, sick of it all, hardly able to take in the importance of what he was saying. The boy, who had leapfrogged into the Indian teacher, sat snuffling. His nose was obviously damaged, perhaps broken, but he had to sit there with his fingers trying to stop the flow of blood, trying to keep from enraging the teacher further. And I thought then, what is the purpose of it all? Why so much suffering? Why do those who have it in their power to show mercy, compassion, and understanding, why do they, instead, behave in a sadistic manner? I resolved that as soon as my guide came back, I would have to delve more deeply into these problems, which were truly perturbing me. But I saw with considerable pleasure that the Indian teacher was looking a little tired, looking a little hungry and thirsty. He kept shifting from one foot to the other. We boys sat on the floor, all cross-legged except me, and I had to keep myself as unobtrusive as possible. The others sat cross-legged in orderly rows. The teacher normally patrolled at our backs so that we did not know where he was from moment to moment. But this man, the Indian teacher, he was shifting from foot to foot, looking out of the window, watching the shadows move across the ground, watching the hours pass by. He came to a decision, drew himself up and said, "Well, we will have a recess. Your attention is wandering. You're not paying heed to my words. Words which can influence the whole of your lives for eternities to come. We will have a recess for 1/2 hour. You are free to partake of your food, and then you will return here quietly, and I will resume my talk." Quickly, he crammed his papers into his leather bag. It snapped shut with a very satisfying click. Then, with a flurry of his yellow robe, he was gone. We sat rather stunned by the suddenness of it all. And then the others jumped to their feet with alacrity. But I had to climb up painfully. My legs were stiff. I had to support myself by leaning against the wall and more or less pushing one leg before the other. But the last one out, I made my way down to the domain of the friendly cook monk and explained to him the position and how I, an innocent one, was being punished as well for the sins of the others. He laughed at me and said, "Ah, but how about the young man who was dropping pellets of soot? Is not that the case, that your karma is catching up with you? And is it not the case that if your legs had not been damaged, you might have even been the ringleader?" He laughed at me again, benevolently. He was a nice old man. And then he said, "But go on, help yourself. You don't need me to help you. You've helped yourself long enough. Have a good meal and get back before that awful man loses his temper again." So I had my tea, the same as I had for breakfast, the same as I'd had for lunch, sampa, the same as I should have for years, Sampa. We Tibetans do not have watches nor clocks. When I was in Tibet, I never even knew of the existence of a wristwatch, but we were able to tell the time by something within us. People who have to depend upon themselves rather than upon mechanical contraptions develop some different powers. Thus, I and my fellows were able to judge the passing of time quite as accurately as those who wear watches. Well before the half hour had ended, we returned to our classroom, returned cautiously, as quietly as the mice which fed so well upon our grain down in the storerooms. We entered in an orderly procession, all except the boy who had a bleeding nose. He, poor fellow, had gone to the infirmary where it had found that he had broken his nose. So I had the task of presenting to the Indian teacher a cleft stick in which was wedged a piece of paper bearing the reason wherefore the boy, now a patient, could not be present. The others sat, and as we waited, I, standing with my back against the wall, bearing the stick in my hand, idly fiddling with the fluttering paper in the end. Suddenly, the Indian teacher appeared in the doorway and glowered at us, and then he turned and scowled at me. "You, boy, you! What are you doing there playing with a stick?" he asked. "Sir," I replied with some trepidation, "I bear a message from the infirmary." I extended the stick in his direction. For a moment it looked as if he had not the faintest idea what he should do. Then suddenly he snatched the stick with such a jerk I almost fell on my face. Dropping the stick, he took the paper and read it. As he did so, his scowl deepened. Then he screwed up the piece of paper and flung it away from him, a grave offense to us Tibetans, for we regarded paper as sacred, because it was through the medium of paper that we were able to read history. And this man, this Indian sage, had thrown away sacred paper. "Well, what are you standing there gawping for?" I looked at him and gawped more, for I saw no sense in the way he was going on. If he was a teacher, then I decided I did not want to be a teacher. Roughly, he motioned for me to get out of sight and sit down. I did so, and he stood again before us and started to talk. As he told us, Gautama had found a different way of approaching reality, a way in which was called the middle way. The experiences of Gautama had certainly been twofold. Born as a prince, with the utmost in luxury and comfort, with an ample supply of dancing girls, the Indian teacher's eyes grew wistful. And all the food he could eat, all the pleasures he could absorb, and then, from that, to abject poverty, suffering, reaching almost to the point of death by privation, starvation. But as Gautama readily understood, neither the riches nor the rags had the key to man's eternal problem. The answer, therefore, must lie between them. Buddhism is often regarded as a religion, but it is not a religion in the strict sense of that word. Buddhism is a way of life, a code of living, whereby, provided one follows the code precisely, certain results may be obtained. For convenience, Buddhism may be called religion, although to those of us who are true Buddhist priests, religion is the wrong term. The only term is the middle way. Buddhism was founded from the teachings of the Hindu religion. The Hindu philosophers and religious teachers had taught that the way to knowledge of self, knowledge of the spirit, and the tasks confronting mankind were as one walking along the edge of a razor, where the slightest leaning to one side or the other would cause one to topple. Gautama knew all the Hindu teachings, for he was at the start of his life a Hindu. But by his own perseverance, he discovered a middle way. Extreme self-denial is bad. It leads one to a distorted viewpoint. Extreme indulgence is equally bad, for it equally leads to a distorted viewpoint. One can, with profit, regard the conditions as those existing in tuning a stringed instrument. If one over-tightens the string of an instrument, such as a guitar, eventually it reaches breaking point, so that the slightest touch will cause the string to snap, and there is, therefore, in this over-tightening, a lack of harmony. If one releases all tension on the strings of the instrument, one again finds that there is a lack of harmony. One can only get harmony when the strings are correctly and quite rigidly tuned. That is as it is in the case of humanity, where indulgence or oversuffering causes lack of harmony. Gautama formulated the belief in the middle way and worked out the precepts whereby one can attain happiness, for one of his sayings was, "Happiness he who seeks may win, if he practices the seeking." One of the first questions which a person asks is, "Why am I unhappy?" It is the question most often asked. Gautama, the Buddha, asked why he was unhappy. He pondered and pondered and thought of the thing and thought around the thing. He came to the conclusion that even a newborn baby suffers. A newborn baby cries because of the ordeal of being born, because of the pain and the lack of comfort in being born and leaving the comfortable world which it knew. When babies are uncomfortable, they cry. And as they grow older, they may not cry, but they still find ways of giving voice to their displeasure, to their lack of satisfaction, and to their actual pain. But a baby does not think about why he cries, he just cries. He just simply reacts like an automaton. Certain stimuli cause a person to cry. Other stimuli cause a person to laugh, but suffering, pain, becomes a problem only when people ask, "Why do I suffer? Why am I unhappy?" Research has revealed that most people have suffered to some extent by the time they're 10 years of age, and they have also wondered why they have had to suffer. But in the case of Gautama, this question did not arise until he was 30 years of age, for the parents of Gautama had done everything they could to stop him enduring suffering in any form whatever. People who have been overprotected and overindulged do not know what it is to face unhappiness, so that when unhappiness eventually is thrust upon them, they're not in a position to deal with the matter, and often they have a mental or a nervous breakdown. Every person at some time has to face suffering and face the reason for suffering. Every person has to endure physical or mental or spiritual pain, for without pain there could not, upon earth, be any learning. There could not be any purification or driving away of the dross which, at present, surrounds the spirit of man. Gautama did not found a new religion. The whole of the teaching of Gautama, the whole of Gautama's contribution to the total of human knowledge, is focused on or about the problem of pain or of happiness. During his meditation, while the creatures of nature remained quiet that he might meditate unmolested, and while the snails cooled his sun-heated head, Gautama realized pain, realized the reason for suffering, and came to believe that he knew how suffering could be overcome. He taught these things to his five associates, and the things he taught became the four principles upon which the whole of the Buddhist structure rests. These are the four noble truths with which we shall deal with later. The shades of night were falling. Darkness was descending so rapidly that we could scarcely see one another. The Indian teacher loomed against the window. His outline showed in the faint starlight. He continued talking, forgetful or uncaring of the fact that we boys had to be up for midnight service. We had to be up for the 4 o'clock service, and then we had to be up again at 6 in the morning. At last, he seemed to realize that he was getting tired. He seemed to realize that standing there in the darkness with his back to the starlight, he was perhaps wasting time because he could not see us. He could not know if we were paying attention or if we were sleeping as we sat. Suddenly, he slapped his hand on the lectern with a resounding thwang. The noise was shattering, unexpected, and we all jumped with fright, so that there must have been several inches of air between our bodies and the floor. Then we all fell back with dull, soggy thuds and grunts of surprise. The Indian teacher stood there for a few moments, and then he said, "Dismiss," and strode out of the room. It was easy for him, I thought. He was just the visitor. He had special privileges. There was no one to call him to task. He could now go to his cell and rest for the whole night if he wanted to. We had to go to temple service. We climbed stiffly to our feet, and I was the stiffest of all. Then we stumbled out of the dark room into the darker corridor. It was not usual for our classes to be held at such an hour, and there were no lights. The corridors were familiar to us, however, and we trudged along until we came to one of the main corridors, which, of course, was lit by the inevitable flickering butter lamps, the butter lamps which were set in niches in the wall at head level, and which it was a constant task of two monks to keep filled with butter and to tend the wick which floated on the surface of the liquid butter. We stumbled on up to our dormitory, where we fell upon the floor without more ado, trying to gain a little sleep before the trumpets and the conches should call us to the midnight service.